OK, so I'm going to talk about two different topics. I originally thought that was one too many topics for a 20-minute talk. And then I heard Joel's talk. It's fine. So I'm going to talk about two separate but related things, galactic conformity and clustering as a function of specific star formation rate, Starship 1. The first half of the talk on galactic conformity is work led by my graduate student, Angela Birdie, in a paper that's published. And then the second part of the talk is a paper that I wrote using my former student, Alex Mendez's results on clustering. They're both using the Primus Redshift survey. These are some of my other collaborators on the project, including a couple people in this room. OK, so again, just to remind everybody about galactic conformity. So this is an observed correlation between whether a, I'm going to put it in quotes, central galaxy is quenched and its neighbor galaxies are also quenched. We've been talking about one halo versus two halo conformity. So again, one halo is a correlation between central and satellites in the same halo being quenched. Two halo is a correlation between a central galaxy and one halo, and then centrals or satellites in adjacent halos. OK, so one halo conformity was first observed in Sloan by Frank's graduate student, Simone Weinman, in 2006. This is from their paper. So this is using a group catalog in Sloan. This is looking at the fraction of galaxies that are star forming as a function of halo mass in three different bins in luminosity, whether they call something star forming or quiescent based on colors or specific star formation rate, they basically get the same thing. So again, this is just the one halo term, and the conformity signal is the difference between these lines. So this is the star forming fraction when the central is star forming, and this is the star forming fraction when the central is quenched. So it's the difference between those that's the conformity signal. So again, this was first seen using group catalogs, just looking at the one halo scale. They didn't see this as a function of scale. So later papers did this as a function of scale, and so we've been talking about this two-halo conformity, I would say, observed and livelyly debated in Sloan. So there's sort of ongoing discussions about whether that's real, which I think are really interesting. So I'm going to talk about trying to do these measurements not in Sloan, at redshifts closer to a half to one. So the previous measurements of conformity before our work outside of Sloan were one halo only, and they used photometric redshifts. So we're going to use the Primus sample. So these are spectroscopic redshifts. They're in four different fields on the sky, covering 5.5 square degrees for this study, from redshifts 0.2 to 1. So we started with a parent sample of 60,000 galaxies with spectroscopic redshifts. And then we split into star-forming or quiescent using an evolving cut in the star formation rate stellar mass plane. So this is showing the Primus galaxy sample in different bins in redshift, star formation rate versus stellar mass. And so this is our cut. So above this is star forming, below that is quiescent. OK, so when we do that, we also apply the stellar mass completeness cut of the survey. And then we want to identify central galaxies, which is hard enough in Sloan. It's even harder at higher redshift. So we used similar isolation criteria as the Kaufman paper, the 2013 paper in Sloan. So we call isolated primaries, or IP galaxies, galaxies that have no other galaxies within a projected distance of 500 kiloparsecs physical and stellar mass greater than half the stellar mass of the isolated primary galaxy. So when we do that, that cuts our sample down to around 20,000 isolated primary or central candidates. So this is showing you stellar mass versus redshift, and the contours are the blue is star forming and the red dashed is quiescent, just showing you the distribution of these isolated primary candidates in this space. And the first thing to notice is just that they have a very different distribution in this space of stellar mass versus redshift. So you have to take that into account if you want to measure conformity. So if you don't take that into account and you just plot the fraction of galaxies that are star forming as a function of distance, so this is projected distance 0 to 15 megaparsecs. So people seem to be using quenched fraction now. Anyway, this is 1 minus quenched fraction. So this is for if the isolated primary is star forming versus quiescent. There's this conformity-like signal that persists out to 15 megaparsecs. That's not real. That's because there's differences in the redshift distribution and the stellar mass distribution of these isolated primary samples. So small differences in the median stellar mass and redshift of your star-forming versus quiescent isolated primary galaxies can mimic a conformity signal. So we match the full distribution in stellar mass and redshift, and when we do that, most of that signal goes away, especially on large scales. So now there's only a signal out to, you know, maybe 3 megaparsecs. So it cuts down our isolated primary samples pretty substantially. But they have the exact same stellar mass and redshift distribution. Okay, so zooming in now, this is, again, the late type fraction as a function of projected separation from 0 to 5 megaparsecs. Again, blue is when the isolated primary is star-forming, red is when it's quiescent. So there's no signal now out here on larger scales. There is a signal on smaller scales. This drop right here is an artifact of our isolation criteria. So that's not what I'm talking about. The conformity signal is the difference between these lines here and here. So again, because what we care about is the difference between those lines and not the overall shape, we're going to, instead of plotting the star-forming fraction, I'm going to show you the normalized signal. So just the difference between these divided by their mean value. Okay, so that's what this is. So this here's our conformity signal at redshift 0.7. So this is the normalized signal, again, as a function of separation. So there's basically nothing out here. This is the one halo term. This is the two halo term. Okay, so paying attention to error bars. So first of all, the signal is small. Okay, so the one halo signal that we see is 5%. It's only 3.6 sigma significant. I'll talk about the errors in a second. The two halo signal is 1%. It's tiny. The previous papers looking at one halo conformity at redshifts greater than 0.2 had signals of like 20 to 50%. Okay, so we're finding 5 and 1% on two halo scales. Okay, in terms of, and then this is only 2.5 sigma significant. And we did the error bars. This is just illustrating what you get if you use bootstrap errors versus jackknife errors. So we're using jackknife errors here. So again, we have multiple fields on the sky, and then some of the fields are large, and so we can split them a few times. And so that's how we do the jackknife errors. If you just do bootstrap errors, you get error bars that are about a factor of 2 smaller. So this is particularly important, of course, as you go to higher redshift. Okay, so the main point is the signal is small, and you really should be doing jackknife errors at high redshift. Again, this is just to show how important it is to remember that there is cosmic variance. So this is the percentage signal in the one halo scale, just for different fields in our survey. You can see that it varies a lot field to field. So basically, a meaningful measure of conformity at redshifts greater than 0.2 should include several spatially separate fields. Okay, so the conclusions here are that basically you need to be really careful with differences in the stellar mass and redshift distributions of your star-forming and quiescent centrals or isolated primaries, because not taking it into account can mimic a conformity-like signal. And cosmic variance can be substantial, so you really want to be using multiple fields if you're doing this at intermediate or high redshift. And then the signal is really small. So again, in Sloan, at least in the original paper by Wyman, the difference was like 10, 15%. So we're getting 5% in the one halo scales, much, much smaller than previously reported in the literature. And then this is the first measurement of this on two halo scales at redshifts greater than Sloan, and we get a 1% signal that's 2.5 sigma significant. So take that for what that's worth. We're in the process now of quantifying what the contamination is in our isolated primary criteria due to satellites. Because of course, you know, it'd be really great when we take spectra if they're like tagged by the universe with an S or a C telling us if it's a satellite or a central. But it doesn't work that way. And as hard as it is in Sloan, it's harder at higher redshift. So what we're doing is we're using halo tools to quantify what the contamination is for the criteria that we used for this paper. And so the two halo term could be due to contamination due to satellites, could also be due to differences in the stellar mass to halo mass relation for star-forming and quiescent central galaxies, which brings me to my second topic. Okay, so galaxy clustering as a function of specific star formation rate. So there are a lot of papers on galaxy clustering observed as a function of stellar mass. There's surprisingly very few papers on clustering as a function of either star formation rate or specific star formation rate. And I think it's really interesting to see how galaxy clustering depends on galaxy properties, not just between the red and blue or star-forming and quiescent populations, but within each of those populations separately. So a few years ago, using Deep2, Nick Moscheck and I found in a paper where we looked at clustering as a function of all three of these things, that within a given stellar mass range, looking just at star-forming galaxies that were above the main sequence were less clustered than star-forming galaxies below the main sequence with the same stellar mass. I thought this was interesting because it could constrain how galaxies evolve, not only along, but maybe across the star-forming main sequence with time. So we've updated this now using Primus and Deep2. And so what I did is I sliced and diced the galaxy population as much as I could in the plane of specific star formation rate versus stellar mass. So I did four different runs. So the first one, this is lower redshift and higher redshift, so 0.2 to 0.7 and 0.7 to 1.2. The gray is showing you the full galaxy population, and then the colors are showing you the galaxy subsamples for this particular run. So this first run, we stuck to being stellar mass complete for the survey. So this is above the stellar mass completeness limits, looking at just star-forming versus quiescent galaxies in the same stellar mass range. And then I said, forget about comparing star-forming versus quiescent. How about within each population? Let's look at above or below the main sequence of star formation. And then within the quiescent population, looking at high versus low specific star formation rate, kind of like on the higher side of the red sequence or the lower side of the red sequence. And then I got bold, and I was like, let's just make a whole bunch of cuts in specific star formation rate. And then I was like, OK, we're going to slice and dice this every possible way, because what I really want to do is see how the clustering depends on either stellar mass at a given specific star formation rate or specific star formation rate at a given stellar mass. I should say, OK, so this is the only run that is above the stellar mass completeness limits of the survey. These are not. OK, so here are the results. So this is showing the lower redshift bin on the top and the higher redshift bin on the bottom for the runs 1, 2, and 3. So this is the one where it's stellar mass complete, and I'm just comparing star-forming to quiescent. This is the one where I took the red sequence and the main sequence and split them into high versus low. And then this is the one where I did a bunch of cuts in specific star formation rate. OK, so there's very clear, strong trends here. Not only between red and blue, but within the quiescent and star-forming populations with specific star formation rate, and then across the whole galaxy population. OK, so this is just to show these results visually in terms of specific star formation rate versus stellar mass. So this is a lower redshift on the left and a higher redshift on the right. This is that run, too, where I split the blue into two populations and the red into two populations, and then the one where I did a bunch of cuts in specific star formation rate. And the points here are at the median stellar mass and specific star formation rate for that sample. And the color is showing you the bias. Okay, so red is higher bias, blue is lower bias. So this is a little hard to see the color differences here. But basically, across the main sequence, there's a difference in the bias. And across the red sequence, there's a difference in the bias, even at a given stellar mass. OK, so here's just showing this the usual way. So this is bias versus stellar mass, and then bias versus specific star formation rate, where I'm overplotting both of the redshift bins. This is for the run 2 versus run 3. There's a few things I want to point out here. So first is that, you know, all these papers that look at bias as a function of stellar mass, generally they're above the stellar mass completeness limits, but even taking that into account, the specific star formation rate is often changing for those samples. And that's generally not talked about. And so I'm just pointing out, you can plot the bias as a function of specific star formation rate and get trends that are just as strong with specific star formation rate as with stellar mass. So I think it would be great if people kept in mind that the specific star formation rate might be changing for your samples where you're looking at clustering as a function of stellar mass. The other thing I just want to point out is at a given stellar mass, here's three different samples that have really different bias values, from 1.2 up to 2.7. And the difference in those samples is their specific star formation rate, not their stellar mass. OK, so now I'm showing the relative. So that was the bias. That was the clustering of the galaxies compared to the dark matter. Now, forget dark matter. I'm just going to show the relative bias between two different galaxy samples. So that's what this is, relative bias from 0 to 3.5 as a function of the stellar mass ratio between those two galaxy samples, or the specific star formation rate ratio between those two samples. And the different rows here is this is basically one halo scales and two halo scales. But the trends are stronger on smaller scales, but the trends are the same on either scale. So let's just look at the top here. Okay, so you know, which of these has lower scatter, the right or the left? The right. Okay, so at a given stellar mass ratio, say a stellar mass ratio of around 1, you can get a relative bias anywhere from 0.5 to 3. That's a really large range. What's different about those galaxy samples is that they have differences in the specific star formation rates. Okay, so to show the joint dependence of the relative bias on both of these properties together, it's kind of a weird plot. This is the specific star formation rate ratio between two galaxy samples. This is the stellar mass ratio between two galaxy samples. Again, here I've sliced and diced the galaxy population in even more ways than I showed you on that first plot, because I was trying to fill this in as much as possible. And the color is showing you the relative bias between the two galaxy samples. So red is very high relative bias, blue is a low relative bias. And then to guide your eye, I drew some dotted lines here. So at a given stellar mass ratio, which here it happens to be around 1, so meaning that you've got two galaxy populations that have the same stellar mass, the relative bias is strongly dependent on the difference in their specific star formation rate ratios. Okay, so at a given stellar mass ratio, the relative bias depends strongly on the specific star formation rate ratio. That's just the fact that the color is changing here as you go in this direction. The reverse is not true. So for a given specific star formation rate ratio, I mean, there's only an order of magnitude difference there, but you know, it's an order of magnitude difference, and there's like no difference in their relative bias. Okay, so at a given specific star formation rate ratio, the relative bias does not strongly depend on the stellar mass ratio. Is that clear what this plot is showing? This is kind of a weird plot. If there are questions, feel free to ask. Okay, so the take home from this is that galaxy clustering depends strongly on specific star formation rate, not just stellar mass. This is true within the star-forming and quiescent populations individually, not just between them. So what I mean by that is galaxies above the main sequence of star formation are less clustered than star-forming galaxies below the main sequence. And then that same trend is also seen within the quiescent population. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think this is might be telling us that the stellar mass-halo mass relation likely depends on specific star formation rate. This is using all galaxies. I wasn't trying to separate centrals and satellites. So we're now testing this by redoing this analysis. This is all published. So what we're doing now with my student Angela Birdie is we're taking the isolated primary criteria from the conformity work and we're applying it to clustering samples. And we're finding that for isolated primaries of a given stellar mass, the star-forming ones are less clustered than the quiescent ones. So we're redoing this now, trying to remove some of the contamination as much as we can. And we're also testing different isolation criteria to try to find, see if there's something better that we can be using instead. Okay, so I think these results should constrain how galaxies evolve in the specific star formation rate stellar mass plane, specifically their evolution, not just along, but across or back and forth the main sequence and between the main sequence and the red sequence. Thank you.
So just following up on your very last sentence, suppose that I have a model that says that galaxies oscillate above and below the main sequence on a time scale where they spend a lot of time below and a little time above. That is, they're when they're above, they use up their gas very quickly and then they drop below. That's, in fact, how the Vela simulations work. Can you say anything about whether that's consistent or inconsistent with your results?
Probably not, but let me say a little bit. So what I did here was I split it right at the main sequence. So the number density above and below is pretty similar. So what you're talking about sounds like if they're spending more time below and less time above, that sounds different. That sounds to me like maybe what you're talking about is more on the main sequence versus very high above it, which is not what I did here.
No, I mean, we did exactly the sort of thing you did, but what we did is we looked at the depletion time and other things like that. And we compared with Genzel's work, where he actually measured gas content, at redshift 2, which is not the same redshifts you can access with Primus. But assuming that things work somewhat similarly down to redshifts like the ones you're looking at, it should be a constraint.
Yeah.
I would guess the constraint says that you think galaxies that are below the main sequence are always below, and
not
those
always,
that are,
but they,
are often below.
They have to, I think.
But the thing that's tricky is that there's a very strong depletion time connection, which is also what Genzel found observationally. So if you're above, you don't spend very much time, whereas if you blow up, you spend a lot more time.
I don't know exactly how to put all this together. There's a bunch of things that people have measured about galaxies that are different if they're above versus below in terms of their structural properties, their star formation surface densities, all kinds of things. And this feels to me like it's saying galaxies need to start more above and move more to below. It doesn't mean they can't go back and forth somewhat. But if they're going back and forth all the time, then I don't understand why they have different clustering properties.
Exactly.
But really, we need to answer this. I think we have to forward model it. Yeah.
I'm out of Pittsburgh. So the clustering result is really cool. I wonder if you try to split the galaxy, the full galaxy sample by the galaxy density, nearby galaxy density, and then look at the joint distribution of stellar mass and specific star formation rate and see how that joint distribution moves.
No, because I'll show you a cone diagram for Primus and you will see why I did not do that. This is not Sloan, is the quick answer to that. Yeah, I don't think we can measure local overdensities super well with this data.
Okay, I have a question related to Joe's question. Mm-hmm. So how did you measure the star formation rate? Namely, what is the time scale of the your star formation
rate? Sorry, I should have mentioned that. So both the star formation rates and the stellar masses come from SED fitting, and we used ICED fit by John Moustakis. But it's from the full SED fit. But so it includes galax out to mid-infrared.
So it's something like 29
No, it's from the SED. It's from the continuum.
Yeah,
we don't have, these are, again, these are Primus spectra, so we don't have individual emission lines for these.
Then everything I said isn't necessarily relevant. So everything I said isn't relevant, because we were looking at H-alpha timescales, which are 10 megayears or less.
Okay. But there still are other things about galaxies that are observed to be different above and below the main sequence, and I'm still trying to figure out how to put all that together with this, in terms of like structural properties and star formation rate surface densities.
Allison, I thought this might be a stupid question. Can we go to that plot that you wanted to explain more?
I was
trying to write while you were talking. Is there a convention that describes how you put these points on this plot? Because I'm thinking to myself, well, I have two samples.
I just made this up.
Well, I'm thinking to myself, I have two samples. One has stellar mass twice of the other. How do you decide if it's a half or two in the ratio?
Oh. Well, I mean, the relative bias will just switch, which I don't think it matters. But yeah, I could have plotted maybe twice as many points.
Like,
as
don't
I did.
These all reflect about the axis for m star equals one?
Yeah, I didn't do.
That actually makes your point stronger, I think, right?
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Because then they're all just in one column, basically, right?
Maybe I could try to fill this out a little bit more doing that. All right, I'll go play with the data.
Can I ask you about completeness and how completeness effects might play out here?
How what effects?
Completeness.
No, it's fine. So most of this, to think about on this plot, The stuff I showed before tended, I was interested in looking just within the star forming versus just within the quiescent population. Sorry, you're being covered. So they have, at least within either of those populations, the stellar mass completeness limit isn't changing too strongly across it. I'm not claiming. So what I'm doing here is I'm plotting it at the median stellar mass ratio or the median specific star formation rate ratio. So even if it's not complete, I still think you could still use the ratio of what the median of the sample is to constrain this kind of thing. But ideally, yeah, you would want to have samples that are, you know, stellar mass complete for quiescent galaxies down to low mass at high redshift with spectroscopic redshifts over a large volume, which we don't have. Yeah. If I did that, I could only do run one. Like, it's just not interesting.
Alessandro Sonnenfeld. So this is a technical point that actually applies to, I guess, most of the observational talks. And it's the following. So we need to be careful when we look for secondary correlations at fixed stellar mass, say, because when we say fixed stellar mass, well, the stellar mass that we have is actually an observed stellar mass with some error.
Sure, but this is systematics won't make it. Will just move all of your stellar masses higher or lower. This won't change this at all because this is relative.
Yeah, okay. But the point is, the point I'm trying to make is, a fixed observed stellar mass, galaxies with the higher star formation rate are more likely to be actually more massive than those with the lower star formation, just because of scatter, because there's a positive correlation between the two quantities. So, and that can make you believe that you've detected a trend, but that's just an artifact. So I think ultimately what we...
I feel like if you have a lot of, if you're not measuring your star formation rates particularly well, you're not going to see trends here.
No, but if the error in the stellar mass is correlated with star formation rate, then that could give trends. Right?
Even without that, just by the fact that the two things are correlated.
No,
anyway, so I think ultimately what we want to do is to forward model, I think, and that gets rid of.
I
all
totally
of this.
Agree.
Actually,
I'm an observer, and I totally agree. You can quote me.
I actually just want to reframe that point. And because Ellison found such a strong correlation between bias and specific star formation rate, actually what that might mean is how you measure your stellar mass. If, for instance, red galaxies, you give systematically higher stellar masses, then your stellar mass estimator will have systematically higher clustering than other potentially more accurate stellar masses. So in other words, based on how good the clustering is, that may not necessarily be a good estimator of how good the stellar masses are because of these strong effects with specific star formation rate, for example.
I think I agree with Alexander's point. Your point was that specific star formation rate is the mass divided by the stellar mass, is that right? Because the observation actually measures specific stellar mass. It doesn't measure star formation, specific star formation rate. It doesn't measure star formation rate. Right? Because the colors only depend on the specific star formation rate, not on the absolute value. Right? Because you're using a spectrum.
Well,
sure. I mean, it depends on other things, but it doesn't depend on the, if the spectrum doesn't change if you double the size of the mass of the galaxy.
Yeah, but that has some errors anyway.
I mean, there is an error because of your stellar population synthesis modeling, but that's not correlated with the error on the absolute stellar mass, necessarily.
It is. So if you look at different estimates of those specific star formation rates, they all have different slopes, which means that there's a correlation between the estimate and the star formation rate and the estimate of the stellar mass, which is just introduced because you're, at the end of the day, trying to calculate a mass to light ratio from the same CVD, and it all ends up being correlated.
Yes, I do feel like forward modeling should help in this, and I do feel like these trends are too strong to be explained by that. I agree that we need to be taking this into account, but my point wasn't even necessarily to like try to replicate these exact numbers, just to remember the overall trend, which I'm sure is not due to correlations in star formation rate versus stellar mass.
So I just wanted to point out that these trends are certainly robust, because you see very similar things if you look in the purely observational plane of color and luminosity, which from Bell and DeYoung is basically a remapping of the stellar mass star formation rate plane. If you look at average over density within group scales, you see exactly these sorts of trends. So it doesn't matter the details of how you're doing the specific star formation rate. The fact that specific star formation rate and color are so closely tied means this is very robust.
Yeah, I could have used color and I basically would have gotten the same thing.
Okay, I see lots of screens being passed around. Maybe this is a discussion to continue over coffee break. Let's thank Allison and all our speakers again. And we'll see you back here at 4 p.m.